reach the Outrider Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to episode 24 of the Outrider Podcast. I am Jason Quinn Malott, and today, I'm very excited about today's episode. We have, there's more than me. I mean, I'm the only one that does all of this, so all of the technical problems are mine. All of the recording problems are mine. I don't have a producer. I'm learning as I'm doing it. It's been a year. You would think I would get better at this. Maybe I need to do it more than once or twice a month. Who knows? Anyway, today, my guest I have on the show, Peyton Marshall. She is the author of who else would be the author of her debut novel except for her? She is the author of Good House from Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. It's an excellent book. You should rush out and buy it. It would be a great Christmas gift for anyone who likes to read. Go out and grab it. Just do it. Find an independent bookstore and get Peyton's book, Good House. Anyway, so like I said, we're going to talk on this. I'm going to get out of the way real quick because we have a great conversation. And of course, we address my my little pet amusing BS conspiracy theory about the Iowa Writers' Workshop. So let's get right to it. Here's my conversation with Peyton Marshall. Go out and get her book. Come on, guys.
Hello.
Hi, Peyton.
Hi, yes.
This is Jason.
Hi.
How are you this morning?
I'm good. I'm still sneaking out of the house here. get out of here, see if I can avoid all the insanity. okay, well, ask Papa for that. make for the front door. I'm gonna go hide in the car. That's my plan. It's my big plan. Not a really glamorous life.
Well, it's certainly adventurous.
You know, only if you take the car out of the driveway, maybe. I don't know, but the rest of that. Yeah, there we go. But I almost made it. I almost was sitting placidly in the quiet area when you called.
Oh, I'm always very nervous right before these, and you know, as soon as that clock hits the button for the start time, I'm like, hey, go, because if I don't get started, I'll continue to run back and forth to the bathroom to pee.
Right. You're like, oh, there's like one last thing to do. Exactly. All right, let's see. The car in the driveway where I might be discovered. So let's go to the car sort of other side of the house. They hunt and look for you, and they always know if you're nearby.
Right.
My kids are like 4 and a half, so and they know that you know where like the brownies are and
right. All the things that they want.
Oh my god. And yeah, quite, all the things that they want.
And aren't quite tall enough to reach.
Exactly. And they know that you have your breaking point and they're starting to figure out what it is and how to work you. Anyway, well, hello. Good morning. All right, I'm hiding in the car now.
And you have coffee or?
Yes, I have some coffee.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah.
Usually I do these in the evenings, and I've got a glass of wine nearby. But I've been.
It looks bad at 8 a.m.
Right.
It often doesn't work out at 8 a.m. So.
Not unless you're on vacation somewhere tropical, you know,
right?
And already slightly hungover, so
right. Yeah, I'm taking it medicinally. Hair the dog.
Well, it's good to get to talk to you. I've been looking forward to this ever since I finished your book. Probably even before
thank
then.
Thank you so much for having me do a podcast. It's really flattering. I appreciate it.
Well. You don't know how few people listen.
Yeah, it almost doesn't even matter. Because, like, it's part of it's just the excitement of, like, oh, you know, like, I put my book out in the world and people read it.
Oh, I know. Isn't it amazing? I'd like to get back to that, get the second one published, but we'll just have to sit here and quietly envy Paul's, won't we?
Right. Although once you've like done it once, it's like, oh my God, how do you do that again? Like, right. It was like finishing a book and just finishing any kind of long project. So difficult.
Oh, very much.
Anyway, it's different going into something the second time when you know, mm-hmm. you know, what's waiting for you, or you think you know.
Yep.
Anyway.
Well, I'm going to actually start in a weird spot. Normally, I like to get everybody's origin story first. But there's a bit of a backstory here that I need to kind of set the stage for. Because I'm going to ask you about Iowa. And because you're the first Iowa Writers Workshop graduate that I've had on the podcast.
Oh, no way.
Yeah. And when I was in graduate school in the in between 99 and 2001, I've always been very, very interested in first novels and what people tend to get their published as their first book. And so when I was in graduate school, I was going into bookstores a lot, picking up books, looking for first novels, and it seemed like all I ever found were Iowa Writers Workshop graduates. I couldn't find anybody else that had a first novel. It's an exaggeration.
Well, that's disheartening.
But it seemed like, and I was like, man, I went to the wrong school. You know, I'd thought about applying to Iowa, but it just didn't really seem to fit. And then the other thing was that it seemed that every Iowa graduate had written a first-person semi-autobiographical Bildungsroman. And, you know, they had, you know, been part of a carnival family, and so their first novel was about being in a carnival family, or, you know, they had witnessed a murder, and so their first novel was about witnessing a murder. And I thought, oh, good grief. And, of course, I would sit around with my grad school friends and get drunk and say, it's a conspiracy! this Iowa conspiracy to shut everybody out. And it's, of course, it was irrational. It was just, you know, drunk and trying to, you know, make myself feel better. But it kind of came this running joke. And so I have people that I think would be mad at me if I didn't ask you about the Iowa conspiracy.
Oh, my gosh. Well, it's funny because there's so many people that go to Iowa that don't publish books.
Exactly.
And, like, aren't able to publish books, that have written novels that, mm-hmm. like, you know, so there's also the feeling of, like, going to Iowa and being, like, you know, am I good enough to be here? Like, right. I don't have a novel. And then, you know, I wrote a novel and nobody wanted to publish it. And there's like so many ways to feel shut out and excluded, right. and to doubt yourself and doubt what you're doing. So I would never have applied to Iowa, but my friend applied to Iowa and she got in and I was like, holy shit. So I applied and I got in and it was like amazing. The time that like between when I got in and when I actually went was like this huge high. I was like, I'm going to go to the, you know, the writing school and it's going to be amazing. And then I got there and it was absolutely terrifying.
Right.
I mean, everybody seemed like really brilliant and like confident, like they knew what they were doing. And I, you know, I'd been in a band for many years and I hadn't really written that much in the past 5 years. And I thought maybe there'd been a mistake. it was like absolutely horrifying. And I wrote, and I ended up finding like a great group of people and having a really wonderful experience. But I definitely got to a point where, you know, okay, I'm graduating in a few months. I don't have a story collection. I don't have an agent. Mm-hmm. I don't have a novel. I don't have anyone who's particularly interested. You know, Iowa is like, we love you. You're fabulous. Just, you know, call us when you're famous.
right.
And I mean, that's a little bit of an exaggeration, but that's kind of how I felt. I felt like there would be people to support you, like if you wrote something. But first you had to write something and you had to write something that came together and that, you know, that you had really edited. And anyway, so I ended up having a big panic of like, what am I doing? Can I be doing this? And I started writing a book. It was a murder mystery because I was like, I was doing the same thing. I was looking at first novels and I was like, what do people like? What would people be interested in reading? You know, even if I'm not a great novelist, like what would hold their attention? So I just killed off a character in the first chapter and thought, isn't this wonderful? And wrote the rest of the book around that. And it was a pretty terrible book.
I hesitate to tell you about my terrible first book, but...
please do. I love it, though. Oh, it makes me feel better.
I'd had this brief fling with this girl that went to a different college on the other side of the state. It was a long story how we got into it, but I decided I was going to try and write a novel about that relationship, you know, and of course it was your first person, you know, semi-autobiographical thing. It was just the most, and I stole the title from a Neil Young song. So, right. So that one's in a very deep, box buried somewhere, I think still at my mother's house. You know, that one's just horrible.
Oh yeah, but those are so hard to write. Those things where you're writing about something that really happened to you, I think that they're almost harder to write than when you're setting a novel in like a place you've never been, kind of thing.
Right.
That makes me feel better.
I think it makes me feel better to hear your story about Iowa because it confirms the theory that I actually have, which is that no matter what writing program you go to, that first year that you're there, you're always convinced it's a mistake. What did I do to get in here? How they must have been desperate for, you know, fees or tuition or something. Or
I know. When will I be unmasked?
Well, when will I go? Oh, we made a mistake. Why don't you go back? Right. I think that happens everywhere. And just like
I really felt that it was kind of horrendous.
Oh yeah, and of course, I think what else always happens is that they crank out graduates, Iowa, Naropa, Columbia, whatever, they crank out MFAs every year, and not all of them become published writers.
Most of them don't.
Some of them become editors, you know, publishers. They go off and start their own presses, or they just, you know, they teach literature. They get a different degree in something else, you know, a PhD in literature, whatever, and they just become your standard, you know, English professors. And but I think what the reason that Iowa looms so large is because it's the oldest.
Right.
And because there is this, they've kind of permeated everything because there have been so many graduates from Iowa for so long. It's really easy to assume it's this conscious, you know, evil conspiracy when it's not. It's just there's a lot of them out there, and it feels like
it's a big program. I mean, they have a lot of, I mean, compared to other programs where you have, and I'm not, I don't know the numbers offhand, but like some programs have like six people or something in them.
Right.
You know, and Iowa has, I can't remember if it's 30, you know, in fiction or maybe it's even more.
Right, right.
Actually. Yeah, you're right. No, there's a lot of people. So.
And even though it's not
a numbers game, then they're just going to win.
Right. Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I've heard a lot of former Iowa professors kind of argue against the whole thing. And in a way, I do sort of agree with them that they don't go out of their way to push a certain aesthetic on the workshops and on the students. But even at my graduate program, there was the teachers, you know, they're kind of mission, even in the class, was to say they weren't pushing an aesthetic. They were open to everything, but an aesthetic developed within my class.
Right.
That, you know, even though we are consciously trying to fight it, it's still there. It still affects what we like as a group and what we push. And so, yeah, I think the important thing is that, yes, you have to be aware that there's going to be a class aesthetic, and then you have to be aware of the effort to challenge it, if that makes sense.
It's just the whole thing can become so complex, you know, like what the workshop likes, you know, like isn't the kind of work that's most best suited to like what you're interested in, or But still, there's a lot for you to learn in the workshop, even if your work, you don't feel like you really have your readers there.
Right.
And then the point of being in workshop is to learn more about writing and about yourself as a writer and have time to work. And so, but it becomes this complex thing where, but you want some positive feedback.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to just be like, and doing, you know, going it alone. And yeah, no, I experienced that too. I mean, everything is just very complex.
Right.
And plus finding, you know, like this deep connection with your work and shutting out like all the voices is like, mm-hmm. is this good enough? Will people like it? Well, they tore a story apart that was sort of like this. And last time, you know, this happened. And, you know, like finding a way to shut that down and like get in touch with like, well, what do I really care about? And what do I really want to spend time saying?
Right.
Is, I found that really challenging too,
mm-hmm.
just because there was so much going on,
oh, yeah.
You know, in those kinds of programs.
Oh, yeah.
All the time.
And unless you're independently wealthy or never went to college, you can really get. Okay, there we go. Long story, I'll tell you about it soon. The computer
okay.
likes to think okay. that my disk is too slow today for some reason. But the thing
coffee.
About the.
Coffee.
Yeah, it needs coffee. I'm fine.
Yeah.
But that place, that graduate school, is really the only place where the modern writer gets to just take the time to concentrate on the craft. And here's where we can circle back to your biography. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Virginia, outside of D.C.,
oh, wow.
in Plain, Virginia. Yeah, and it was sort of, we moved there in the 70s, and it was kind of horsey with little farms. And now, of course, it's crazy. It's just mega mansions and freeways and all kinds of stuff. But that's where I grew up. And then I came up to Portland in 91, and I kind of stayed out here.
Oh, wow.
I know, right?
So what was it that got you first interested into writing? I mean, was it something early on when you were a kid, or was it something later? And when really was the first time that you remember ever meeting someone in person who actually had been published?
Oh, God, those are all really good questions. I had a hard time reading as a little kid. I had a hard time. I just had letters kind of wiggled around a little bit, vowels sort of superimposed themselves on top of each other. And I just struggled with it. And it all just kind of clicked at once. I remember being very sick once as a little kid, and I couldn't sleep, and I was just up all night. And I had a pile of books next to me that I was supposed to be reading, which, of course, I wasn't. I remember the first time I wrote a book report where I'd actually read the book. And it was so easy. It was just like a revelation.
Right.
Because I would spend hours trying to write a book report. I hadn't read the book, and I would look at pictures and just think about like how it could possibly be coming to my face. I wish I still had them. I'm sure they were completely insane. You know, summaries based on the pictures.
Right.
Which may or may not have had anything to do with the book. But anyway, so I read this book, Socks, which was about this cat. That there was like a new baby in the house, and the cat was very angry and took off and had some kind of adventure before coming home and reconciling itself to the arrival of, you know, the expansion of his family. And I read the whole book. I sat up through the night and I read the whole book, and it was just like this revelation. I was like, this was amazing. Like, rather than sitting here feeling terrible and staring at the wall and, you know, like seeing shadows and being afraid,
mm-hmm.
I like hung out with a cat, and I like was like in a cat's brain. And I walked around the neighborhood, and like, it just seemed like magic.
Right.
You know, all of a sudden I understood the magic. And then I really started reading more and more. Like, we would get these little, I don't know what they were, like Scholastic, like a little newspaper thing that would come like every month to the classroom, and you could circle like three books. And then they would come, and you would take them home.
Yeah,
I'm sure it's like a service or something that.
Oh, yeah,
kind of
I had those.
For.
Oh, yeah. My parents bought me so many books that I never read through that Scholastic service.
Oh, yeah. No, but I was just, like, so excited when they would arrive and, like, take them home. But yeah, okay, just Scholastic Service. Yeah, that's it. Just Scholastic books. Anyway, it was all very thrilling. So that's how I first really got into reading, started getting into reading. And then I did some writing, like in sixth grade, we had like a creative writing week. And
my God.
Ruth Glass was my teacher.
Right.
And we were supposed to, you know, be working on a story all week, and a week seemed like an incredible amount of time.
Oh yeah.
And I just like threw myself into it. There was a girl on an airplane, and it crashed on an island, and only her trusty dog survived, but she broke her leg, but she made a splint, and you know, she was, I don't know, there was an evil curse on the island that was like claiming her, that it caused the plane to crash, and just as she was going to be reunited with her parents, like at the airport, which she's like battled through the jungle, like the evil curse like claims her. And I worked like feverishly on this, and I printed it out on the computers where it would print the text continuously, and then you would have to rip the pages, so it would just kind of rip one sentence in half, and you'd be like, oh well. I don't know if you remember those like dot matrix printers. It was like, it was very exciting. It just seemed like part of, you know, part of reading that book. And
right.
I felt more engaged in that than lots of other things I did in school.
Yeah, me too.
That's kind of how I got started.
Yeah, that's kind of when I got started too. Sixth grade, my teacher, Connie Jobe, had these worksheets she'd hand out, where it was you would get to finish a story or start a certain story based around a certain theme. So it'd be like Lost Treasure, and there'd be these fragments of stories, and you would work around that. And I loved it. I just dived into it and wrote all these things. And she would always pick a couple of stories, you know, every week to read to the class. And there was this competition between me and this kid named Lars Ellingson. It was just because it was either going to be his story or my story that got read, you know. Just,
oh my God, that's so cool. Yeah, that's totally that age. That's so cool. Do you have any of those? Any of those worksheets or anything?
I think I might have one floating around somewhere in a box, but I know I've got a couple of the stories left.
I have my sixth grade story somewhere. I saw it like a few years ago before we moved. But I was always like, I always thought it would be great to do a collection of these stories, like the first story.
Right.
You wrote, I think we were going to call it like What I Did Before I Knew What I Was Doing. You would have like the original story, which would be, you know, just as crazy as these stories are.
Right.
And then I thought I would get people to rewrite the story.
No way.
You know, like, and it could be any kind of, revision. It could be sort of a literal revision. It could be like, you know, the story is actually symbolic and this is about, you know, whatever. But I thought I would love to read that book. That's one of those things where you think about, like, well, what's the book I want to read? Like, I would totally want to read that book.
That would be great.
Yeah, maybe.
I'll help you with that.
You know, if I ever get it together.
I'm volunteering to help you with that.
Okay, yeah, great. You're hired.
So when was the first live writer that you met? Live writer, like we keep them in zoos.
Yeah, a live writer. Let's see. I'm thinking, I have a cousin, I think he's a cousin, who is a writer.
Mm-hmm.
His name's Neil Duncan, and I was always aware that he wrote books. And he'd written a book called, I think it was She Came From Good People, was the name of her book, of his book. And I remember I met him. He was sort of a family friend.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know. I felt like I didn't, like a writer was somebody sort of far away in another place,
mm-hmm.
You know, in some kind of, I don't know, some English countryside somewhere.
Right.
How about you? Who was the first writer that you met?
College. It was either Gary Clift or Steve Heller.
Huh.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up out in Western Kansas, so if there were any writers, nobody admitted to it.
Wow. Yeah, right.
And I ended up, went to high school in Wichita, really in a little suburb of Wichita, that at the time was known for its rampant anti-intellectualism. They once tried to ban Shakespeare from the English curriculum.
Oh my God, amazing.
I know, right?
Oh. Wow.
And so,
you
know, I'd thought when I left high school, I was going to major in journalism because that's kind of what I'd been doing in high school. And I went up to K-State and was looking through the course catalog and saw that I could major in English creative writing. And I thought,
oh my gosh,
great. And I don't have to take economics. You know,
sold.
I'm doing that. You know, I've been writing stories since it was, you know, a kid. So it made perfect sense. Completely impractical. I mean, I regret it.
Every time,
I see my paycheck, I regret it.
Yeah, I know. Well, but then I feel like I know people who made the opposite choice, who wanted to write, and then they, you know, chose a different path for various reasons. And then they always wonder, like, well, what would have happened if I, you know, I'd really given it a shot? Mm-hmm. So I feel like it goes both ways.
Yep.
Yeah.
So how old were you when you made the move from Virginia to Oregon?
I think I was 18. I went to college out here. I went to Reed College. And just kind of packed up, moved out here. I don't know. I mean, I feel like when you're that age, you just kind of end up places.
Uh-huh. Right.
And you're like, I don't really know how I got here, but now I live here. People.
So are your parents still out in Virginia, or are they?
Yeah, they're still in Virginia. They're still in the house where I grew up. It looks exactly the same.
No way.
Yeah, they repainted my room pink when I left. So it's like all kind of preserved, a little time capsule. Kind of fascinating.
Oh, my.
How about you? Do you still have family in Wichita?
Oh, yeah. My dad passed away several years ago. Mom's still here. You know, my sister lives in New York, so it's interesting. I don't have a whole big family. Most of the family's in Oklahoma, and they're right-wing-ish, and I don't talk to them.
Right, yeah. Oh, that. Yeah.
So when were you – I caught this briefly before. When were you in a band? Did I hear that right?
Oh, I was in a band that was – in college in like 90, I don't know, 3, 4, until about 2000. And sorry, I'm watching my kids cross the street over here. They didn't see me. They just walked right past the car. Yeah, well, they're with Paul, so it's fine. They're not wandering off. Anyway, I'm like hiding from them. Yeah, so I was in a band in college. It was called The Third Sex. And The Third Sex.
Third Sex.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
And it was an all-female punk band.
Rock on.
It was awesome. I mean, it was really awesome. So, and actually the woman I started the band with, Trish Walsh, she ended up going to Iowa. And that was the friend who I was like, damn, I'm going to Iowa too. So, we were in this band together, and then we both went. To Iowa.
Did you take the band with you to Iowa?
We kind of did, in a way.
Right.
We found a drummer, a poet, and we played a couple shows at the farmhouse, which was the sort of party house when we were there. And it was fun. It was really fun.
Which instrument did you play?
I played guitar and bass guitar. We swapped back and forth. I know, a la, like, 90s punk style.
Right.
It was super fun. But I did mostly songwriting. So, like, after, you know, when I was in college, I think I wrote a bunch in college. But then afterwards, I mostly just wrote songs.
Oh, cool.
So that, you know, by the time I ended up in grad school, I was like, I don't know if I remember how to write a story. Which is sad, because I have to turn one in like, 2 weeks.
So did you...
That created a lot of panic.
As an undergrad, were you majoring in English or music or both?
I majored in English because I wanted to write a creative thesis. At Reed, you have to write a thesis and then, you know, if you want to write a creative thesis, you have to be an English major.
Okay.
So I majored in English. I would have majored in history, though. I sort of preferred history classes to English classes. But anyway. I took a bunch of English classes just to enable my writing habit mostly.
Amazing. No, that's cool.
Amazing.
So can we find, did you guys record any? I mean, can we find some Third Sex albums out there?
Oh, yes. You can find some albums out there. I got
something to look for. That'll be cool.
Yeah, you can find them. They're out there. They were on Chainsaw Records, and we had a 7-inch on Kill Rockstar.
Nice.
Records, and we have a Mr. Lady. We have a EP on Mr. Lady. Can't remember.
That's cool.
Yeah, but it was all kind of before the internet, so it's all
right.
I don't know. It's funny.
Huh?
Not as visible.
Right. How long have you been playing the guitar and the bass? When did you start?
I started in high school, kind of in a Crosby, Stills, and Nash drumming on your guitar sort of pseudo hippie phase, fairly embarrassing. And then I was really into Joni Mitchell and when I was a youngster, and then Liz Phair and all of the lady singers.
Yeah.
Kind of went from there.
Cool.
Thanks.
That's cool. Yeah.
How about you? Do you play anything or?
Well, not officially, no.
Unofficially.
I was briefly we like to say that we were the world's greatest crappy band. The origin story of that one is basically I had a friend named Scotty who played the guitar and a friend named Bieberly who played the drums. And one night in the dorms, they were, goofing around in one of the practice rooms. And I wandered by and kind of stood in there and was just hanging out and listening. And Scotty goes, Jason, you should get a bass guitar and learn how to play like Les Claypool. We'll call you Slappy. And I thought, all right, I could do that. I'm not writing anything right now, and I need to do something creative. So I went out and I dropped $120 on on this knockoff cheap Fender Precision copy. That had this skull sticker on it. We called it the skull bass, and a practice amp, and ran back to the dorm and pounded on Scotty's door and was like, we're a band.
That's awesome.
and they taught me how to tune my bass guitar, EADG, which I've never forgotten because they gave me a great mnemonic for it. I had a friend named Eric Ames who was in our little circle, and he said, here's how you can always remember that. It's EADG, which is Eric Ames Does Girls. I thought,
I'll remember that forever.
Thanks. So they would, Scotty, who never learned how to read music, but could play everything by ear, he was like, okay, here's what these are. Here's how you do this. And he would just start calling out chords while we were playing. And I would find that on the string and, strum away at that. And that was how we got started as a band.
It's great. It's a great way to meet other people and spend time with people. And I don't know. I mean, I loved it.
So I still have my bass. I don't have an amp anymore. I think about taking lessons to actually, figure out how to do something.
I'm sure it's overrated. You just dive in. It'll be fine. Nobody knows what they're doing really, right?
Well, that's kind of the way it goes, I seem to prefer learning by doing. I mean, I think that's the way it is with most writers, is you always learn by doing. You learn by doing by, you just sit down and write. Yeah, you take some classes, people get helpful, but if you don't do it, you don't learn how to do it. Podcasting, playing in a band, just get out and do it. Don't don't let not knowing stop you.
How long have you been doing the podcast?
Just over a year.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Just kind of one or two people a month. Right now it's at one person a month. And then I have this thing I do with an old classmate of mine called Shop Talk that comes out every other week. So it's a lot of fun.
That's very cool. Well, I remember Paul doing this, talking with you, and he hid in the back bedroom, and I was doing kids in the front of the house.
Yeah.
I think that was about a year ago.
No, that was like that a year ago. Earlier, maybe. I don't remember.
It's maybe, I don't know. Time is moving very quickly, so.
It was, I think it was early, it was early 2014, because it was when you were still in the pre-pub for Good House.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Because that was how I found out about it coming out. I was like, oh. And immediately went out to my independent bookstore and put it on order.
Bless you. Good man.
Hey. No, I think the world out there is hard enough as it is. It's twice as hard for first-time novelists, no matter where they went to school.
Oh yeah, no, it's really. I mean, it's hard because I really care about the book.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously, I wouldn't have spent 7 years writing it if I didn't really care about it.
Right.
But I'm not one for self-promotion, and I'm like, I wrote it.
You've got to get used to it because that's apparently the rules of the game these days.
I know. I need to be tweeting and Facebooking and blogging and all these things. And it's like, Jesus. But I wrote the book. Isn't that enough? Right. I know, right? When can I read a magazine or something?
So
I don't know. That's exciting. I mean, go ahead.
I was going to ask, what were the assorted nuggets that made up the inspiration for Good House? Where did the fragments come from? You know, because there's no corner shop down the street, you know, to go grab a story idea, and story ideas don't always just, you know, ping right out of the ether. It takes time to get all the just my, there we go, components.
Better. Okay. Did you pour more coffee into the computer?
Right.
Get electronics and coffee. Well, the original idea, I think I've been reading a lot of articles about, you know, how you just waste time on the internet flipping through the New York Times or something. And I must have read enough articles about, you know, we've identified the gene for impulsive behavior, or I think there were some Dutch brothers who committed a bunch of crimes, and they had a genetic mutation, and they thought maybe the gene was responsible for their criminal behavior, you know, stuff like that. And I started thinking, like, what would it be like if we really had this information? We really want this information, that's clear. But what if we really had it? What would we do? And how would that look? You know, if you're a child and you're like, okay, kid, you're going to want to do some bad stuff in your life, and you're going to have to. So I started thinking about, like, what would this school look like? And I kind of woke up with that first scene in my head, the kids getting ready to go out on their, like, community day to do some service.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of from there, I started reading about, you know, juvenile incarceration, the history of incarcerating children in our country, and which, I mean, hasn't changed that much. I mean,
really?
I know we're shutting down more and more of these facilities, but it's really just for budgetary reasons, not because, you know, people are so outraged, although they should be. So I began doing more research and reading more firsthand accounts of kids who ended up in, and specifically in the California Youth Authority, and what their experiences were like, and what their lives were like, and what their outcomes were like.
Right.
And then I really based Good House on kind of an extension of that. Like, well, what would this look like in the future, based around genetics, but really being one of these institutions, kind of like how they were in, you know, 1890 and 1990.
Uh-huh.
And I read a lot about the Preston School of Industry. I don't know that you really read the book, so you're probably familiar with that. It's and it was built in California in 1894, I think, or 96. Mm-hmm. And it was built to provide, you know, wayward boys, homeless boys, boys who had committed some kind of crime or truants or something, and provide them, but basically boys who are poor, provide them with a skill, a job skill that they can then take out into the world. But that's not really, you know, it's kind of like the idea that was the ideal, and the reality was much, much different.
Right.
Like what that became was very different. So,
no, I think
that was kind of the impetus.
Yeah, cool. Because I think it has. I think the book has a lot to, you know, say on that deep, you know, metaphorical, suggestive thing about our apparent passion for incarceration in this country. That it's just overzealous and ridiculous, and I look around at the way we think about, you know, prison and crime and violence and everything like this, and I think when dystopian fiction works, it's when it seems entirely 100% plausible. I could see that happening, you know.
And one of the reasons it seems so plausible is because it is happening. Like we incarcerate more people and more children than any other industrialized nation.
Yep.
And then you get these whole communities who rely on these institutions, and you try and shut them down and you can't.
Right.
You know, there's too much pushback, and you're bringing in people, usually poorer people, mm-hmm. into these small towns and locking them up, and then that kind of creates this lifeblood for those communities. It's kind of creepy.
Yeah.
And then it becomes this generational thing, like people mm-hmm. whose parents are incarcerated are more likely to go to jail, and they're just kind of feeding this institutional animal.
Right. Yeah. And then
it's very creepy.
Yeah, especially with the privatized thing with that, when you know it's like a publicly traded prison corporation, and it's, you know, we have this insistence on, you know, increasing profit every year. And how many laws and weird wacky things are they pushing for to make sure that every year they get another body in the prison?
Oh, it's absolutely true. And like nobody's trying to help these people, like,
right.
or, you know, like reform. I mean, there's that, you can get an education, or it's just not really true. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just a way of destroying people's lives. Right. And I find it very upsetting, depressing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
and it also makes me a little cranky when I've had people say, you know, like, oh, your book is, you know, Good House is just like another, you know, it's based on a bunch of YA novels, or it's, you know, whatever they said in the various reviews. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, no, actually, it's based on how we run our world right now.
Right, right.
So, I mean, there's the futuristic genetic component.
Was there any push? Anyway. Was there any push to market this or put this out as a young adult book from the publishers?
There wasn't.
Really?
So, and thank goodness, because I didn't want to, you know, like, sort of neuter it, you know, and make all the dialogue sanitized, and you know, I didn't want to have kind of a limit on what I could write.
Right, right.
I guess that felt like in conflict with the subject matter, even.
Mm-hmm.
Like making it more palatable somehow. Right. I didn't want to do that. But it's funny, I was working on the book, you know, 7 years ago, there wasn't really this genre of the dystopian future fiction, which is mostly, not entirely, but mostly YA. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I finished the book, and then all of a sudden it's part of a genre. I'm like, yay!
Right, right.
You know, yay if it helps people find the book, but, you know, it's also a little frustrating if people are, look at the book and they're like, oh, we already know what this book is or what it's like. And I'm like, no, actually, it's really, it's different. I didn't read any of those other books while I was writing it. So.
Right, right. Yeah, the dystopian YA.
It's just a funny thing.
Yeah, the dystopian YA stuff tends to have this kind of triumphal change the world feeling to it, rather than the more realistic, I guess you want to say, kind of dark and less hopeful. I don't want to say nihilistic, because the ending isn't nihilistic, but it's not the triumphal we've changed the world type of thing that a lot of the YA dystopian stuff shoots for.
Right. I don't think that's how it is. I mean, sometimes you're lucky to, you know, escape with your life.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's enough.
And
not to give anything away, but
yeah, he's not a public hero at the end of the book, which I think is more realistic than the other options.
Yeah, they would never let him be a hero.
Not at all.
I don't know. Yeah.
What are you working on now? Where's a?
Oh, what an excellent question. I have a couple things that I'm working on. I'm just writing, like, to see what I think about them. It's funny. Yeah. I mean, now that I know, like, I could be married to something for like 7 years, I feel like, oh, I have to feel like there's enough questions there to keep me interested, enough like depth to, you know, get me in the chair every day, even mm-hmm. if I, you know, have a sinus infection or haven't slept, or, you know,
or the kids have a sinus infection.
Right. And they haven't slept. So I don't know. I'm still trying to figure out what I want to do next.
So,
how about you? What are you working on?
Well, we'll get to that in a second. I feel like I talk about that so much, and there's so bizarre stuff. But what is it that you're reading? What's the fiction and the nonfiction that's kind of feeding into some of these ideas? Because if you're like me, you don't talk about the story you're working on, because that's telling the story before you've told it, and that just shoots it right in the foot.
Well, I've been reading a little bit. Well, we're moving to Morocco in a few weeks. Paul's teaching. I know, right? Wow. Paul's teaching a semester abroad.
Yep, saw that. That's cool.
We are packing it up and heading over there. So I want to read more about the history and more about the Ottoman Empire and that kind of thing.
Oh, cool.
Which makes me, of course, sort of want to write a story. Right, but in like, you know, the Ottoman Empire in mm-hmm. 1500. That sounds so easy. Gosh, what could be easier?
What's easier than historical fiction?
Right, gosh, right? But it's funny. I mean, talking about Good Half to Few, people, I've had people say to me, like, oh, you know, well, this is, you just were thinking of the movie when you wrote this book. And I was like, are you kidding? Like, the thought of writing about a boy in a violent institution, from mm-hmm. a boy's perspective, in the future at a violent institution, like, that seems totally crazy hard to me.
Right.
Like, I didn't even know I could do that. And now thinking about writing about, you know, the Ottoman Empire, you know, just the historical time, I'm like, that, mm-hmm. I don't even know that I can do that. That's just crazy hard. So that's kind of what I'm thinking about. I might do a contemporary, mm-hmm. I'll do a contemporary story. That's fun. Although it's probably, you know, sort of deceptively harder somehow.
Well,
I don't know.
I say go for the crazy hard thing, because if you don't challenge yourself, how are you going to keep your interest? I mean,
right, exactly. I feel that way too.
And I hate that writing advice. You know, write what you know, and it's like, because everybody wants to take that literally. So if I were going to write what I knew, it would be about, you know, a guy growing up in the Midwest that was scared of talking to girls. And nobody wants to read that book.
Right, exactly. Right. And plus, I think it's really hard to write what you know, because like you trying to write about that relationship, it gets confusing, because you're not, your loyalty isn't just to the story. It's mm-hmm. to like this other narrative, which happens to be your life. It gets all mixed up. I think it's much easier if you're writing, for me, you're like a very like, you know, this is from the perspective of a talking rabbit in a, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And you're like, you're loyal to the story because you don't have any other connection to it.
Right. Why isn't the advice right about what you want to know? You know?
Yes, that's great. That's perfect. That's perfect advice, right? Because you're going to spend all that time reading and, you know, educating yourself. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like that.
I'm reading a lot of Joseph Campbell right now.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That a mist.
Yeah.
Mist and face and that kind of stuff.
Well, I'd read The Hero with a Thousand Faces years ago, and now I'm getting into the the Masks of God books, you know, like primitive mythology and occidental mythology and stuff like that, trying to, because what I'm kind of interested in is creating a story that comments upon the decline of mythology and its rebirth, you know. So using mythology as the thing that's going through the mythological journey. Did that make any sense?
That's kind of interesting, like how it evolves, you mean?
Yeah. Because Campbell had said that we are in a period between functional mythologies. The old mythologies that got us to where we are now are kind of losing their power. This idea that the tenor of the mythological metaphor is still relevant, but the vehicle has lost its resonance. Since we're not as tied to the earth and to animals and the environment, we've kind of separated ourselves from it. We don't relate to that metaphor the same way. So we can read mythologies about deer and antelope that are actually gods that are, you know, somehow, you know, mirrors of humans, and it just becomes fantasy. It doesn't mean anything. We don't connect to it that way. And so we're having to find new kind of mythologies that address the world as we know it now, because mythology is always the thing that sits on the other side of the limit of science. So science knows all this stuff about the world, and mythology sits where there's still the mystery.
Right.
And, you know, 2,000 years ago, the mystery was much closer to actual human existence. We've pushed the mystery so far out there that those old mythologies don't work anymore. So we're kind of...
Yeah,
so I'm
that's true.
Trying to write a story that is about the story of a mythic creation.
Is it about a new mythology, or is it the creation of that new mythology?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, I'm also trying to take some personal narrative, basically creating a myth out of family history in order to do it. But so we'll see how that goes.
Wow, that's the kind of thing that would keep you showing up at a desk for 7 years, though. Like people ask me, like, what were your conclusions when you wrote Good House? Like, what, you know, what answers did you arrive at? And I was like, you know, I didn't arrive at any answers. I just kept finding more questions.
Right.
And what you're talking about, it seems like, you know, that's like, it's just a rich vein. You can just ask questions and then you're done. You'll never find the absolutist answer. But that's why I think, you know, you're on to something interesting. Something that is compelling.
I hope so. Otherwise, I'm just kind of, you know, eating my own brain.
Well, there is that too. It sounds really interesting, though.
Oh, thank you. So how is the book doing, yours?
I don't know. I don't go online and check on it.
Really? You're able to avoid that kind of, you know, self-obsession.
Yeah, no, it's because it's just a poison for me. Like, I get upset when people write stupid things, or, you know, or like I get, like, you know, somebody will write something complimentary and I feel like too happy about it, and it's just like, oh, okay, I need to just fill this let it go, you know, let it be its own, have a separate life from me. So yeah, no, I haven't like gone online for like a month and looked at anything. I try to give that's Paul's job. If there's anything I need to know, he'll let me know.
So what is it? I think I asked Paul's this question similar to this, but what is it like living in a house so intimately with another writer?
It's great. I love it. I mean, I think I find Paul so interesting. He's always so full of ideas, and he's so passionate about art and about writing, and I feel like our time together is just this extended conversation about, you know, about our lives and about our work and about our thoughts about, you know, what we're reading, what we're considering. I don't know. I mean, I find it a really sort of rich and interesting life. And yeah.
Sounds like a great permanent workshop almost.
Yeah, but where, you know, people are they're much nicer to you.
They're not out to cut you down to keep themselves elevated, right?
Right. They're not like limbering up before your workshop. We're just gonna shred this. No. So it's fun. I really like it. And of course I really enjoy his writing and his sensibility and all that. So that makes it easy.
Yeah, it would help. It'd really, really be a tough situation if you didn't like each other's work.
I know. Ooh, this again.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was the thing. I did briefly room with a friend of mine from graduate school. And it was at times difficult. But I think that was
you get in a creative funk sometimes, and it's not as awesome when you're both in a creative funk.
Yeah.
I mean, then it's like a, you know, you've rolled snake eyes or something.
Yep. Well, and then you also kind of have to learn to keep your ego in check.
Yeah.
And I think at the time when I was in graduate school, what was his name? Brian Evanson. He was taught a workshop there one summer, and we were having this conflict between the poets and the fiction writers, you know, some aesthetic conflict, right? And
the sharks and the jets, right?
Right. And he had said the thing about unpublished writers is that they all are very militant and angry and about their aesthetic, because it's the only thing they have to justify their existence to their parents.
Oh my God, that's so inflammatory. That's hilarious.
You know, and so, you know,
he did not.
and they don't tend to become more generous about all of that until they get published, because then they can just let the work speak for itself, and they don't have to fight over, well, you know, writing should be about this and writing should be about that. And
I don't know. I don't know if I agree with that, but that's interesting.
I can understand the disagreement. For me, it felt real. And I think it felt real because at the time I was having grown up in the situation that I was in, where there were no writers around, and people thought that writers had, you know, were these special people that just lived in New York, and, you know, that can never be you.
Right. Yeah, there's somebody far away from you.
Yeah, arguing about the aesthetic and saying, no, writing is this and this and this, and it has to be this and this and this. It was a way for me to kind of defend and protect myself from the constant doubt that was being hurled at me, coming from where I do. And
that's really useful. I mean, you have to find a way to protect yourself from that. Otherwise, you won't work.
Right. Yeah, and so, yeah, and then with my roommate, she had come out of graduate school kind of doing all the right things, the things that we were talking about before, that we were like, well, I don't have an agent, I don't have a collection, I don't have all this other stuff. And Laura Holly, she had come out of graduate school getting a story picked for the Best New American Voices of 2003, you know, the one that Joyce Carol Oates edited. And,
wow.
You know, and it was a capper story, the last story in the book. So it was like, wow.
Wow.
And she landed an agent because of that. And then at that time, in that little brief window, I was very happy for her. I was proud of her. But at the same time, because I'm a self-obsessed little jerk, or at least I was then, it was like, when is that going to happen to me? And she thought I was upset at her for surpassing me. And so there was this four-month period where we weren't talking to each other. And I would go downstairs to my room, and if she was in her room, she would leave and go upstairs to watch TV. And if I came upstairs to watch TV, she'd go down to her room. like 4 months of this, just not talking to each other. Right.
And oh, it's like a misunderstanding.
Just out of this misunderstanding, because I was too self-obsessed to just to not hide my disappointment at my own failure or perceived
failure. Right. No, it's, there's so much anxiety of like, well, you know, am I going to be able to do this? How will I support myself? Like, does this matter? Am I any good? Like, it's so hard. It's just so hard.
Yeah. Oh, and when you see your best friend get some success and you wonder, why the hell can't I be happy for it? And it's because you're a self-obsessed jerk. So I learned that
funny,
lesson.
Like, yeah. Like, I found sometimes other people's success just triggers my own worry. Because I feel like there's a limited number of, like, it's like musical, you think it's like musical chairs. Like, the music's going to stop. And if you don't have a chair, then you just have to slink out and leave. I mean,
exactly.
It's not like that, but it feels like that sometimes.
Oh, it does. Definitely does.
Yeah, no, I totally understand. So how did it resolve? Did you guys finally like just be like, oh?
I think at one point, I just kind of was standing there in the kitchen. I'd come home from work, and I don't know how it. I just kind of like said, we have to talk about this because I am not your maid.
You're like, this is going to be an awesome conversation.
And we spent like an hour hashing it out, and it was like, you know, at the end of it, we're both sitting there going, I'm an idiot. No, I'm an idiot. I'm sorry. You know?
And you're like, why did it take us 4 months?
Why did it take us 4 months? And it's because we both kind of had this, part of the reason I guess we became friends is we both had the same way of dealing with things. You just kind of enfold into yourself and you kind of figure out, am I the problem? And you don't ask.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, it's a good lesson. Like, it's also so funny when you check in with someone and you realize that, like, you've both been, like, you just totally misunderstood each other.
Yeah.
You're like, okay. I need to be better about, you know, just saying what I think. Or
Right.
Oh, my God. Yeah, but I totally remember that feeling. Like, especially, you know, going to Iowa and people would be like, you know, I'm in the New Yorker, you know,
right.
I have a collection coming out and I was like, oh, it just made me feel like this panic, like, well, I'll never, like this feeling like, well, if they get that, then I'll never get that or something, which I don't know. I mean, everything just feels impossible starting out as a writer.
Oh yeah.
It just, I don't know. And then you keep having to come back to like, well, what are you doing? Like, why are you doing this?
Right.
Like, what do you really care about? What do you really want to spend time like thinking about? Like, what books are you really grateful for? And like, what really feeds you? And I don't know. It's hard to keep coming back to like that core, you know, that place where you have these sort of core beliefs.
Right.
And not get distracted by all the
The
crazy.
Yeah. And I'm finding it particularly hard to keep the burnout at bay. And it's not burnout because, oh, I've done this too long. It's that I've put too much, you know, emotional pressure on myself. I have to do this. I have to do this. It has to be good. It has to. And losing track of that why I started writing when I was, you know, 12 years old to begin with, that kind of just joy at reveling in your own imagination. And that's been the hardest thing for me to keep in check is that personal, you know, focus and pressure and getting into that burnout phase where you've just paralyzed yourself. You sit down and you're just like, I can't be good all the time, so I won't be good at all.
Right? Yeah. I know what you're talking about. Something I found that helps me is to have creative projects that that put me back in touch with that feeling of just, you know, like excitement. Things that are, you know, like making a pair of pants for my son, you know, it's like, it's achievable. It's not like writing a novel where you're like, this might all go down in flames. Like it's achievable. It's pleasurable. It's tactile.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like your brain is kind of a neutral, but also engaged, but you're like, you know, engaging with creativity in this positive way. I don't know. I find that helps my writing. So like be building something, you know, like a table or a, you know, or planning something or just kind of, I don't know, being more in touch with like a happier kind of creativity. And then I feel less you know, prone to that kind of like suffocating grip of expectations.
Right, right. I think it's time for me to buy a new bass and an amp and find some guitar players.
Yeah, totally. No, that's totally like the right impulse though. Like if you're, yeah, like just go and like start a crazy band and maybe like you'll meet like crazy people and be horrible, but it would be really interesting. Like engage you in this like sort of playful and creative like
right.
thing, which is part of or should be part of writing, I think.
I'm on it.
But isn't always. All right. Yeah, put out your Craigslist ad today.
Okay. So, okay, now what is it that you're doing outside of the writing and the raising children and things like this? Are you teaching?
I taught this last summer. I taught like a summer class. So I do that, you know, periodically.
Mm-hmm.
For a while I ran a business like remodeling houses. And
oh, wow.
I still have some rentals that I run. Yeah. And so I don't know. I'm not sure what's next. I might do like a construction project when we get back from Morocco. That sounds, I just all around Portland, people are, the banks seem to be handing out money. So maybe I'll do something like that. Or maybe I'll find another book and be kind of deep in that. I don't know. I don't really know what's going to happen.
Well, I look forward to you and Paul's posting from Morocco. That's kind of how I travel, is vicariously through my friends.
All right. Well, we'll do some blog posts or something. It's going to be wild. I don't even know what to expect. Anything could happen.
Right. I've got a couple more questions, and then I'll let you go.
Okay.
We've been at it for an hour, although I'm sure we could go on for a while. These are kind of my... This is the stuff that I kind of ask everybody.
Okay.
Now, every year, the National Endowment for the Arts and other people, they come out with the reports on the arts in America, and there's a lot of hand-wringing about how literary reading is declining.
Yeah.
And then you have, on the other side, you know, people like Amazon, stuff like this, reporting that book sales are rising every year. You know, ebooks are just this enormous thing, and then, you know, people are buying books, but somehow at the same time we're over here, literary reading is going down, and you know, and then of course we have all this, the constant conglomeration of publishers and the struggles that independent presses have, and it's hard to say really what is true. Are we really becoming a nation of non-readers, or are we so ghettoizing and genreizing the literary environment that the only people that are going to be selling books are the people that write serialized, you know, genre fiction, and the rest of us are just kind of getting this narrower and narrower audience of college-educated elitist snobs?
No.
Right. But, you know, so, and I... But the thing that I've always thought is that as writers, we kind of have a responsibility to the literary environment. It's something that we rely on. So like conservationists or anything like this, we should be concerned about how literature is addressed and taught and put out into the world. We should make an effort to... I'm not talking about marketing here, but make an effort to reach out to and encourage and get people reading, not just our own books, but everybody else's books. So I'm wondering, and I always like to ask people, what are some of the things that you think we as writers should be doing to foster and sustain and grow a literary community?
Gosh, that's a good question. I mean, I'm not sure. I mean, people, I think that, I don't know that, I'm sure literature is changing. You know, I think about Dickens, and were his books considered great literature when they mm-hmm. came out, or were they just considered entertainment? I think they were considered entertainment, and now they're, you know, they're literature.
Right.
So I think that like what literature is kind of depends on who's reading it and when it's read. But I think that people are very eager to engage with story, you know, in different ways. I don't know. I don't worry that the writing is getting too schlocky or anything, because there will always be writers of exceptional quality, and then other writers who are more, you know, dedicated to a story, you know, the storytelling and not language itself. And there will always be readers who are more interested in language or language with story or just kind of story itself. I just feel like it's always been a broad spectrum, and it will remain a broad spectrum. Mm-hmm. And the hand wringing is just the hand wringing. And if something's going to evolve and change, it's going to evolve and change, and the writers will evolve and change with it.
Mm-hmm.
And like what the lag time looks like, or how, what it looks like as it evolves. Like, you know, I don't know.
Yeah.
But I do think, like, you know, we reach our kids a lot, and I think that that's really important in terms of creating a community of, like, a literary community. Kids grow up with stories. They grow up feeling engaged with ideas and other people's minds in a way. They sort of develop a habit of engaging.
Right, right.
And I think that's really important. And I think that that's kind of how you create the literature of the future. It's people's desire to engage with writing.
Right.
And I think the desire to engage is better than not having the desire to engage. So I almost don't, you know, I don't worry about the quality of the books I read to my kids. Like, is it about Transformers? You know, shouldn't it be about Anne of Green Gables, or, you know, like, whatever? Mm-hmm. I'm like, no, as long as they're excited, I think it's fine.
Right.
Kind of my feeling about it.
Yeah, we're not, well, I don't think, I think the thing that always reassures me every time I see the hand wringing and stuff like that is that humans are not, you know, they've always, scientists and philosophers and people like that have always tried to, you know, say, well, this is what makes humans different than animals. It's tool use. And then we find out that they're animals that use tools, you know.
Right.
Or we say it's language, and then we see, you know, gorillas learn sign language and can tell us that they feel sad that Robin Williams died, you know.
Right.
So it's not, it's not language that separates us. And what I think it is, and I think it always has been, is the thing that separates us and makes us special on the planet, our one claim to exceptionalism, is storytelling.
Yeah.
And we're as long as we are human, we're going to tell stories, and we'll find some way to tell stories. And so writers and writing and literature will always be important as long as we continue to tell people that it's important. If we find a way to get out there and say, this is important, go read it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. I don't worry that it's ever going away, because I also believe it's just kind of fundamentally part of who we are.
Mm-hmm.
So what it looks like, who knows? But it will endure, whatever it is.
Oh, I sure hope so, because I would hate to see a human species that was not telling stories. They'd be animals.
Really?
That was my oh, most, my gosh, obvious statement ever on the face of the earth.
I like it. No, it's good. It's good. I'm there with you.
Oh.
Okay. All right. Well, I think I have to get my kids ready to go to soccer. How's that for glamour?
That's good. Peyton, it was great to talk to you.
This was so much fun.
Agreeing to do this. Don't go anywhere just
yet. Really wonderful.
Cool.
Okay.
All right, there you have my conversation with Peyton Marshall. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. Be back in 2 weeks. We'll have another shop talk with Laura Holly. I think this one will be a bit more organized. We're taking on some rules and things I've learned from listening to old radio guys talk about the business. So we're going to actually have a plan. And then after that, it looks like we might have an interview with Scott Phillips, Fred Ramey from Unbridled Books, and some new writers who you've probably never heard of before. So keep listening. Thanks. Bye.